Hello and welcome to episode 90 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
Unfortunately, we've got no cookie this week, but as ever, you can find the show notes for this episode at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk, where you can comment and find links to our social accounts, plus you can get in touch and ask us questions or comment on the show by email at contact@nerdsassemble.co.uk. You can also listen to this episode on Stitcher or iTunes rather than downloading. But what's happening this week?
Well, this week we've got Batman vs. Superman, subtitle is a bit naff. PS4 owners seem to love PlayStation Plus. Doctor Who is back in August. No Ubisoft games for Wii U or 3DS to be shown at this year's E3. And our feature is an interview with Hannah Bunce of Tutorials by Design.
But first up, I'm sure you've all heard the subtitle for the Batman v. Superman film. Dawn of Justice!
Whoa.
This is the Dawn of Justice.
Dawn of Justice! So, not Twilight of Justice, because it'd be less sparkling.
Well, presumably they call it Dawn of Justice because they're, well, almost making the Justice League.
Yeah.
But it sounds so cheesy!
Yep. Justice League.
Yeah, but it's still Batman v Superman, : Dawn of Justice. Just, I can't handle, as somebody who works in a copywriting agency, I can't deal with the way they've put it together. The Avengers sounds cool. Even Justice League can sound cool because it's just two words.
Even though the Avengers, I was shocked at the lack of Steed and Mrs. Peel.
Even Avengers Assemble sounds kind of cool, but
although the Assemble sounds a little bit,
yeah,
MFI,
which is bad because didn't they go bust?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Okay. Avengers IKEA.
I get that they want to probably set up for a Justice League movie, but I do think they could have just stuck with either Batman v Superman or could have just called it Dawn of Justice. It just feels like somebody went along and was just like, right, well, we're going to be marketing this film in like 9 months or whatever, and we want people to be able to find it easily on the internet, so we're going to pander to the robots and make sure that we get keywords in, and our keywords are Batman and Superman. And because, obviously, it could be perhaps like a bit of a run-up to a Justice League movie, we'll make sure we'll get Justice in there as well. Or maybe that's just because I've recently done a whole load of SEO training. I don't know, but that's how it feels.
I think we should, during this podcast, we should try and come up with a better name.
Oh, God.
How about, because it's not the full league, if it was just Justice League.
I like that.
Is it Justice Knee? Justice that just comes up to Rob.
Justice Thigh.
Ooh.
I suppose it's just the title kind of, to me, feels like it shows a lack of sophistication.
It's just shoehorning in a reference to me. That's what it sounds like. It's not trying to be clever. It's just, let's put Justice in there. I mean, Batman v Superman is a crap title anyway.
But I think Batman versus Superman, a league of their own, maybe
that could
more
work.
Poignant.
Yeah, but then it sounds like a cheerleader movie series.
That's true. It could do. Or Dawn of Justice, : Batman v Superman.
I'm quite enamoured with the idea now of Bruce Wayne with black pom-poms.
Do you know what?
Where is it? Parents are dead.
Bats would be a better cheerleader than Superman because he has far more grace than Superman. Superman, he might be able to punch really well, but he does not do it gracefully. That, you know, it's just I mean, it takes him forever to learn how to fly without fudging up. So, you know, gracefulness is not something he's got. Bats has got it in spades because of all the training he's had. So, cheerleading contest, Bats is going to win.
Now, you see, a new idea. Superman goes undercover and he's to be a male cheerleader at a high school. But his rich high school friend, Bruce Wayne, has to train him up. With hilarious consequences.
This sounds like a cross between Batman v Superman and 21 Jump Street with a touch of, what's one of the classic cheerleader movies? Oh, from what? Like...
Yeah, cheerleader movies?
Yeah, well, you know, like you've got, is it Bring It On?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just cause it's like you just melted all those into a pot. And just kind of like, and maybe with a touch of Clueless as well, just for good measure. Just saying, could work.
And that would still be a better
Do you know what? There's already, I think, because on like CITV at the moment, some random kind of like youth Justice League type cartoon series, and they're all at kind of like Robin and that are like at high school level.
Okay. So
maybe there's precedence for this. Maybe.
But I think we should get you guys, you listeners, to try and come up with a better title.
Yeah, if you have a better title for Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, then please do, you know, send it in. Carrier pigeons might be awkward and messy, so perhaps not do that. But otherwise...
Be very messy for me, because I've got 4 cards.
Extremely. Yeah, see, don't do carrier pigeon. We're surrounded by cats where we live, so...
We're guarded by them.
It feels like it sometimes. You keep trying to get in.
Poignantly, you could probably, or might be able to tie it to an actual bat to send to us.
Yep. Don't throw any batarangs to get it to us, though.
Yeah, they won't arrive.
Or if they did, it might smash through your windows and stuff. Might or scratch something.
If they used one of the remote control batarangs.
Oh, you got to get through the letterbox then?
Yeah.
Just kind of... Yeah.
And then turn around and then hit an electrical cable.
Yes. And then go through either the same narrow gap you've just come through or a new one.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, I think this is just getting a bit silly now.
It might be, but I suppose we could talk about PlayStation 4s and their owners and them loving the PlayStation Plus.
Well, I don't have a PS4, but I like the games.
It's because obviously PS3 owners can still, you know, get a PlayStation Plus, so, yeah. You know. But apparently almost half of all PS4 owners have a PlayStation Plus subscription.
Which doesn't make sense, because multiplayer needs it on that console.
Does it?
Yep. Yeah.
It doesn't for PS3, though, does it?
No,
it doesn't.
That's rather odd.
I think they just decided, you know, seeing as they were changing generations, to put multiplayer as one of the things that PlayStation Plus had.
Is Battlefield 4 out on PS4?
Yeah.
That's not one of the games anyone successfully play multiplayer on, though, is it? If rumours are... Well, I say rumours. Personal hand-wringing accounts are to be believed.
Well, they seem to be very popular, those games, and I think they just... Yeah.
Yeah.
It's old. Yeah, that 386 running off a floppy disk will be fine. Just use that as a server. Which they always seem to do. Just EA always seem to do that, and...
But I think the interesting news, because this was kind of like, this was like a one corner piece of news from, was it Katoro was announcing last week, because he also revealed that the PS4 is now turning a profit based on just hardware sales. Now imagine how long it took them to get to that point with the PS3.
Yeah, but that's because the PS3 was designed by nutters. Let's have an extremely custom CPU, an extremely custom way of setting everything out on the board, and then at the last minute, slap a GPU on it. That we, you know, we'd said early on that, you know, the PS3 won't need, you know, GPUs. It will just use the power of the cell.
Well, presumably there'd be some customization in a PS4. Otherwise, what's to stop people from, you know, grabbing regular parts and building yourself a PS4?
Ah, but that's things like that. They have a lot of security on it because they learned from, you know, PS3.
Ah.
And especially from the PSP. Which apparently had security, I heard, at some point.
Wait, PSP had security?
That's the rumour I heard.
Okay, it's that I thought it was, you know, one of those consoles that, you know, had been almost like broken to bits so that you can run emulators and stuff on it.
I think it was just fundamentally broken, the security, from a very early point, and there's nothing they could really do to fix that. They tried, but yeah, with the PS3, it's been fairly secure apart from that, you know, exploit. But then they confounded everyone by just patching it out anyway. So, you know, there's been no real progress on the PS3.
Mm.
And when it comes to PS4, it's got a lot of security there. Yes, it's running on pretty much PC hardware. But the way it's put together and the way it's looked after is entirely its own thing.
Just one question, because, you know, we've got a PS3, and Emily's on PlayStation Plus subscription, but I'm not. Mm. But I can still obviously play certain, you know, kind of download titles and whatnot that she's, you know.
Yeah.
But PS4 owners, what about the, well, because obviously when you set up a profile, you can have multiple profiles per console. So is that based upon the amount of consoles there are, or is that based upon the amount of profiles that are generated?
I'm not entirely sure when it comes to, you know, things like PS3, because with PS3, you could have the same profile on two machines, and that would work fine, but any more than that, because they originally started off about 5 or 6, and they found that people were taking the piss with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've sort of dialed it back to two machines, but I'm not entirely sure whether, I presume something like a PS4 would be an extra machine. So it would, you know, it would be fine, but seeing as it's not backwards compatible or anything, it's not going to count as, you know, like a third PS3. So that, you know, you're going to have to deactivate your account on one of them for it to work. But I don't have a PS4 yet. But I have been logging onto the online store and buying, quote unquote, the PlayStation Plus offerings for, you know, the PS4.
That is a cunning idea.
For in preparation for when you do actually finally get it.
So I'll have things like, was it Outlast and that Shoot 'Em Up from the Super Stardust people. You know, games like that will be waiting for me on my PlayStation account when I get a PS4.
That is a cunning move. I just also want to point out that in the last, well, less than 12 months, they've shipped 7 million PS4 units.
Which is quite a nice amount.
And they're hoping, I think, before either the end of this year or the end of their next financial year to have obviously, like, doubled that. So, yeah.
I've still got friends who are keeping track of, you know, PS4s wanting to get hold of them. And there are still places that can't get stock. It's getting a bit better now than it was a few months back, but I mean, you can walk into a store and you can buy an Xbox One. Mm. But it's not a guarantee that you can walk into a store and buy a PS4. There's a good chance of it now, but it's not guaranteed.
I want to move us back. Well, not back. I want to move us on now. Sorry. Oh, wait. Back. That kind of makes sense. Doctor Who, it's back in August. It's coming back. It's about time travel. The whole back thing, yeah. The back thing works, yeah, totally. It was announced on Twitter last week that the series was coming back in August. And I think in the past 24 hours, I watched a teaser trailer has come out. It's like 16 seconds. And
it is very much a tease of a teaser trailer, isn't it?
It's like they just kind of took a pipette and just kind of picked up a tiny drop of trailer, and then kind of just dropped it onto the internet and watched it kind of fizzle.
It's homeopathic trailer.
So that's why it didn't inspire me.
It was very distilled.
Just an outline. Literally, an outline.
Yeah. I get why they would do stuff like that, but to be honest, unless they're kind of original, you know, content, then I think teaser trailers are just a bit... Yeah.
For those of you who haven't seen the teaser trailer and can't be bothered to obviously click on any show links or unable to whilst you're listening to this, the teaser trailer shows, during these 16 seconds, mostly a silhouette of Capaldi's Doctor standing in the middle of the TARDIS whilst lots of things appear to explode behind him from inside the TARDIS.
Wait, is this sequence done by Michael Bay?
I'm a bit concerned about the fact that we've got exploding TARDIS, considering that the beginning of Matt Smith's, you know?
Yeah, that was explodey TARDIS.
Very explodey TARDIS. Very on fiery, explodey TARDIS. But I suppose because knowing now that it's coming out in August, I'm kind of like, I'm starting to be like, oh God, please do something that I don't cringe at so much, or I feel awkward watching, because I've got such a love-hate relationship with Who. I really, really do. It's just, like, there are more episodes that I kind of don't like in comparison to ones that I do.
It's less so now with Moffat.
Yes.
But, yeah, I know what you mean. There was definitely a far higher ratio of just hide behind hands, and not because of scary monsters, but in a, oh, Jesus Christ.
What are you doing, Mr. Davis?
Yeah,
I mean, it's really, I feel like it's a really unusual relationship that I have with, like, the show, because, obviously, I really like the concept, and I've liked the Doctors themselves as characters, and the companions, except for, what was Catherine Tate's character again?
Donna.
I really couldn't stand Donna for, like, the first half of that series. And then I could stand her.
I couldn't stand her for the other half of the series either.
Oh, okay.
Or in other roles.
Basically, you don't like Catherine Tate.
As we've discussed before. But, no, it's I like the show and I like the concepts and I like the characters. But unlike other shows, which I really like, I like most of the episodes of those other shows. Who, like I said, I find it really hit and miss for actually liking the stories that get put on screen. I find it really difficult to kind of be like, oh wow, I really, really enjoyed watching that episode.
I think that's because when it comes to stories about the Doctor, stuff that, you know, basically unravels the Doctor a bit more seems to be obviously the better episodes, where, you know, sort of he may give out a new kind of face to himself, or he, you know, admits something to his assistant or whatever. You know, there's a certain level of character progression. There's a reason why the story is televised and out there, rather than just being like, oh yes, monsters pop up, I do my usual thing, monsters go away, well done, save the day.
But even whether he's got some bits of character development, often I'm not completely keen on them.
To me, it's a little bit like Doctor Who is that mate who you really like, and you know you've known for years, but you know at any moment could really put their foot in it.
That feels like a reasonable analogy. I still think that the last episode I truly, really, really liked, other than the fact that I kind of liked the Day of the Doctor special, but the last thing that I really, really, truly liked that was a regular episode was the Van Gogh one. And that had no real development for the Doctor. It was more for the companion.
It was just an episode, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was the last one I really liked. And, yeah.
And what usually happens is I will really like episodes apart from something. Like, I quite liked that Ghost episode they recently did. In the Stately House.
Yeah.
But then there were bits of that where it was just...
I mean, I like the fact that they keep it fairly kind of science-y or science fiction-y rather than kind of, oh, yes, weird stuff happens and, oh, yeah, it's not explainable by science. No, it is completely explainable by science.
It's explainable with complete bollocks science, but yeah, I know precisely what you mean, yeah. It's just the Weeping Angels, well, they're bollocks. I like them, but scientifically...
I like the fact that they're kind of based upon, well, pretty much kind of quantum theory in a way.
Yeah, I like the rules with them, but... Yeah, it's just don't think too hard about it.
I found them interesting when they were first introduced, but I've found them to become a bit overused.
Yes, they definitely have been lately.
And it's like, obviously that. I mean, that's one of the things that's probably put me off a lot of the series. The fact that like the Daleks and the Cybermen have also been overused, and it's just kind of like I know they're like classic Who villains, but I'd be up for them coming up with some new ones. That are just as megalomania issues and are trying to take over sort of thing.
Yeah, to be fair, though,
you've
got
a whole universe and possible alternate dimensions to choose from.
To be fair, though, I think most of the time they come in, like, either the Cybermen or the Daleks, most of the time they come in, like, once a season. Which, to be fair, isn't that often.
It's the idea though that we've had them as kind of like the root of issues in a couple of seasons now, which is not fantastic.
But I mean, there's a load of different. I mean, what is it, the Vishnu Nuara or whatever it is, the weird things, microscopic things that live in shadow in the library. If you remember that one,
that was a really good idea. Mm. I liked that idea apart from it having Catherine Tate in the episode.
But I think that would be, you know, like another good one to, you know, kind of revisit in terms of, you know, kind of problems or whatnot.
They need more clever ideas for that kind of thing. I like, you know, where they do something slightly weird and it's not completely bollocks, but it's just a strange and maybe slightly creepy idea.
Yeah.
What are we hoping that the new season will bring then? In August, once it starts,
more creative swearing. Warning will not happen.
I kind of hope, because obviously they've kind of cut themselves off with David Tennant, like all of his stuff. Even though it has happened in that universe, it's separate from, you know, Matt Smith's stuff. So I'm kind of hoping that. That Matt Smith stuff will carry on into Capaldi's stuff, if you know what I mean.
That there's not too big a break.
Yeah, that there's not like a, like almost like a separate universe type thing.
I think this Doctor is probably going to be a little bit more harsh. Well, not in a bad way.
Are we saying more like what Eccleston brought to the character?
Talking maybe a bit more like some of the you know, the older original Doctors.
Oh, okay.
The new Who. But just someone maybe, you know, still very enthusiastic about, you know, finding new things out, but maybe, you know, a bit more ready to take more of a moral stand on things.
Okay.
You know, the Judgment Doctor, rather than...
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I think Matt Smith's Doctor, the one thing that I liked about his is that he wasn't quite there. He was a little bit kind of kooky and insane. And I'm kind of hoping... Yeah, and I'm kind of hoping that that instability in his character will stay with Capaldi's.
I think it will be. Maybe just with, you know, because I like Capaldi and other stuff.
Mm.
But I'm hoping he'll maybe be a little bit more like, I know I keep going back, but Tom Baker. in the he likes humans, but they're not as advanced, and sometimes they can be really stupid and do really nasty things. So be a little bit instead of you go, I love you humans, kind of thing that Tennant would do especially, but to an extent Matt Smith's would.
Yeah.
But I think this Doctor might be a little bit more. It's like, no. You can't do that. That's wrong, and I'm going to make sure that you don't.
Mm. Can I just ask, because I think I have heard that Capaldi's Doctor will have some sort of explanation as to why he is that kind of Doctor in relation to his previous stuff in the series, like the Fires in Pompeii episode and whatnot. I have heard that they're connected somehow, and any ideas where that will go, you reckon?
I don't know, because wasn't it Russell T. Davis suggested something like that with it? Because he was in that Pompeii episode, wasn't he?
Yeah. Capaldi. And obviously he was in Children of Earth from Torchwood.
Ah, yeah, but that was crap, so... Because it was Torchwood. Mm. I'm not judging it at all. I am judging it.
I'm kind of hoping that, Clara's going to stick around a bit longer, but that she's not... It's not that I don't want her to die as a character, which seems like a weird thing to say. I want her to end up in the kind of position that Martha did.
I the thing about both Martha and Clara is that they're both intelligent and they're both capable. So where'd you go with a character that is like that?
I suppose...
What could they learn that would, enhance the character?
As I've said before, I just don't like Clara that much. I think it's just her grinning face all the time. I just find her an incredibly boring character, whereas at least, Amy Pond, could kick ass if needed. But, I prefer Martha to Clara.
Mm.
And I thought Martha was a bit of a damn squib.
I think you're possibly right there, but for the same reasons that I said, where could she actually go?
I suppose we could have the character develop a bit more, be a bit more independent in herself, so she's a bit... Mm.
Oh, little request. In any of the, the Doctor Who writers, listening to this, yeah, right. We don't care about the companions' families on Earth.
Although, to be fair, Mickey was actually quite an interesting, kind of side bit.
He was all right, but as for the...
What, Wilfred?
Yeah, but I liked him because of who he was, not his character. Yeah. But most of the rest of the time, it's stop visiting the families on Earth. I don't care. If I want, sub EastEnders, I'd watch EastEnders. I don't, so...
Mm. Well, stop it. That's...
Yeah, you've got someone who's travelling around with an alien in a box which warps time and space, and they keep going for Christmas bloody lunch.
One
year, they're all going to get food poisoning, and it's going to affect the Doctor in the most spectacular manner. That's an episode idea.
Wow, your roast turkey was so bad, the Doctor literally regenerated.
That'd be good, I think. And I know, unfortunately, I'm going to have to move us on to our final news story for the week. In the not unexpected, but yet disappointing news that Ubisoft will not be showing any games for Wii U or 3DS at this year's E3.
The 3DS bit surprises me a bit.
Mm.
Because I know it's not selling as well as the DS did in this stage in its life, but... It's a long way from being in trouble or anything. It's a popular machine.
Yeah.
I was playing on mine, but just before this episode. I was back on Pokemon again. But it's just confirming because it means that the delayed Wii U version of Watch Dogs is perhaps the main game they've got coming out on the system anytime soon.
Mm.
I will still be slightly surprised, seeing as the rumours that are going around that this year they've got Assassin's Creed Unity on Xbox and PS4 and PC. But the rumours are that they're going to be having a separate 360 PS3 release as well, like a continuation of Black Flag.
I thought it was a different game. It was another Assassin's Creed entry, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't Unity.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think that, you know, the 360 and PS3 version is going to be, you know, more of like a Black Flag rather than, you know, the French Revolution that the, you know, the next gen console is going to be.
Mm.
Now, to me, it would surprise me if they would pass up on a Wii U version of that.
I'd kind of hope that, there again, I always hope that, you know, developers don't pass up on the Wii U. Because the Wii U needs more games, and in a way, I think it's deserving of more games. You know, which is why, you know, you're getting a lot of, like, indie, you know, kind of Kickstarter games, you know, kind of come into the Wii U.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good thing. I mean, this, a similar thing is happening with the Vita, but that is unfortunately in trouble as well.
Mm.
I saw some of the, you know, the sales figures for that, and the NPDs in North America.
Yeah.
I might have misread it, but I think they sold something like 3,000 Vitas.
Mm-hmm.
In that month, which is pathetic. Yeah. It's terrible. But I support them, you know, doing more. But the fact that Ubi aren't going to be showing anything, I'm thinking that surely they must be showing something, mentioning it now.
The thing is that Nintendo have really changed tact when it comes to E3. They've preferred going out into places like GameStop and Target to, you know, kind of showcase it to, you know, kind of across the country, along with, you know, the Nintendo Direct. So they're really pushing for a far more inclusive, in a way. Or maybe they're just kind of sick of, you know, kind of the games journalism and whatnot, you know, sort of like doing whatever they like their stuff around E3.
But
you know what I mean.
The thing with going back to the sort of Ubisoft angle and all this is that they've said that they're not going to be showing any games. A rep told us Nintendo will report that they're not going to be showing off any Nintendo games at E3. And, like, I get that Nintendo kind of need to, because we've talked about this before, it's like they need to sort out their first and second party a bit more, and then maybe third party will come along. But I do wonder how things are going to be once Mario Kart's being finished, being released everywhere.
Mm.
Like, whether Wii U and even 3DS sales might improve.
I mean, I think the one thing that has actually surprised me quite a lot about Mario Kart 8 that I think a lot of people are actually quite excited for is the fact that it's got Mario Kart TV, where you can actually, I don't know, I think it's E4, are running a competition where, you know, you kind of stick up on YouTube and whatnot, your race, you know, kind of edited together with, you know, whatever camera angles you want and whatnot, and, you know, slow-mo, reverse, whatever you want. And, you know, you could get featured on and being shown on the channel, which is actually quite a good idea.
That's a nice idea, but it's not new.
Well, I suppose it's new to a certain extent in the idea of user-generated content on E4 from, you know, kind of a particular game. But the whole concept of, you know, making your own videos and whatnot is not new, because obviously Team Fortress 2 has had that for quite a while now.
And doing your own videos was something, or, you know, being able to tune in and watch other people race was something that was at Project Gotham Racing 3 on the 360.
I did not know that.
In November 2005.
But yeah, so I think Mario Kart 8 may kind of push a couple more Wii U's. But I don't think it's either gonna spectacularly fail or, you know, kind of spectacularly succeed.
I think it's going to sell very well to Nintendo fans, and they're most of the people who already have a Wii U.
Mm.
I don't think there are that many people who are real, you know, they're just about going to jump on, but they're just waiting for a Mario Kart.
I know, I can imagine, like, families and whatnot may decide to get, one of the Mario Kart 8 bundles with a Wii U. But, yeah, not like people like you and me, because either we have no interest in it, or we've already got one.
Or we're waiting for it to be cheaper.
Yeah, or waiting for it to be cheaper. But, you know, I think it's the family market that they're really going after with that.
That's not new, because that's what they've been chasing all along.
moving away from Nintendo for a moment and just thinking about what Ubisoft will be showing at E3, which, as we said, includes Assassin's Creed Unity, but includes The Crew, The Division, and Valiant Hearts, but also Far Cry 4. I want to know, does anyone think that perhaps Far Cry 4 might be more, how should I put this, racially and culturally sensitive, more sensitive than what happened with Far Cry 3?
Is it more sensitive?
But as in, like, it's sort of like a bit less racist, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
To be honest, looking at the lineup the Ubisoft titles that have been confirmed to be on display, including Assassin's Creed Unity, The Crew, Far Cry 4, The Division, and Valiant Hearts, how many of them actually seem to or are going to have a protagonist that is female? Or is, you know, I mean, to me, I kind of want to get new experiences, and that you don't get new experiences generally by, you know, sort of playing as a gruff white male character with very little hair on his head, going guns a blazing around places.
I think you mean a space marine.
In essence, yeah.
Yeah. But aren't we all space marines? No, we're not all space marines.
That sounded like it was going to be a philosophical point, but then you kind of backed out.
The philosophical point is, did anyone see that picture going around with, it was the main character from the new Wolfenstein game compared to the pixely portrait from the original Wolfenstein game?
I have not seen this. What was it like?
Well, they're both a sort of, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, square jaw, sort of stereotypical, tough GI guy. And of course, one is sort of semi-cartoony, very low resolution, 256 colour, DOS thing. And the other is quite a realistic looking picture. And of course, the idea is, look how far we've come in games. And it's like, yeah, we've come very far in what we can show in the games, but when it comes down to it, you're still playing a square-jawed, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white soldier. Again. 20-odd years or so, progress. I'm not just talking about, Wolfenstein in general, but it's like, yeah, it's still that demographic that, they think that's what's going to sell.
And I think that's what puts me off a lot of titles for both PS4 and the Xbox One.
It's like, if they have a female character, isn't that being daring and original? Because after all, we are insects. So, there's about 10,000 males to every female. And, the females are the queens of the hive. Because those are the real stats of our species, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't feel like I live in a matriarchy. Not much.
Not really, no.
No, really not.
I'm going to move us on now to what we've been up to this week. Fretroid, what have you been subjecting yourself to?
That's an apt termage. We decided to sit down and watch Silent Hill 2 Revelation.
How'd that work out for you?
I tried to find the receipt for the, near 2 hours running time, so I could get a refund on it, but unfortunately I could not find it. We saw the original Silent Hill film, which, while it wasn't brilliant, it was reasonably close in feel to the atmosphere of the games. But this one seemed to be someone who saw the first film, hadn't played any of the games, thought, oh, you know, I really liked that Hellraiser film. So why don't we have, you know, monsters that have, you know, like circular souls stuck in their heads and utterly dispense with the idea of trying to create a, you know, an atmosphere of dread or spookiness.
Wait, so the film's a bit like Hellraiser. So this instantly says to me, based on my Hellraiser experiences, that if I tried to watch the sequel, I could fall asleep. It's a risk. It's a while since I've talked about this. So basically, for those of you who don't know, I have yet to properly watch the Hellraiser films, having tried watching them when I was a lot younger and been absolutely scared shitless by them. I left it till I was a bit older, tried watching them again, didn't find them scary at all, but found them perfect for falling asleep to.
Which is a little bit weird.
Yeah.
That's our Emily.
It's like, oh, I can't sleep, let's put some Hellraiser on.
But, I mean, to be honest, going back to, you know, Silent Hill, like the original Silent Hill film, one of the reasons why I really enjoyed it was because it was paying homage to the, you know, the games themselves. Okay, so yeah. It wasn't particularly from the first game, apart from certain bits, like, you know, Sybil Bennett and, yeah. But it kind of took elements from, the second one at least, if not third as well. And, yeah, that's kind of what really made the film for me.
Well,
yeah, it sort of fell apart at the end, didn't it? But
what I didn't like about the first Silent Hill film was its BBFC rating, which I still think was too low.
Was it 15 or something?
Yeah, it's 15. I mean,
a woman literally gets skinned alive by Pyramid Head. Not to mention the what was it, the barbed wire...
Rape. Yeah. Barbed wire rape. Oh... And then subsequent dismemberment.
Yeah, it's...
Not to mention somebody actually being burnt alive.
Oh, that too.
Yes, there was that. But then I've been watching Hannibal, and that's rated something like a TV-14 in the US.
What?
Yeah, which... I've seen the season finale for that. I'm not going to spoil anything, but that is not a TV-14 to me.
They're crazy.
But yeah, with this Silent Hill 2, it stars Heather. So if anyone's played, you know, the third Silent Hill, you know, daughter of Harry. And it turns out that she's got some kind of link to Silent Hill. So she kind of gets drawn back.
Ooh. All mysterious like.
Yeah, all mysterious like. It has the change, you know, the darkness change where they enter the dark world and, you know, and the sirens.
Oh, yeah.
But it only does that once or twice, and he just seems to do it utterly randomly and just in a, ooh, look, we're making something weird happen.
Mm.
Whereas in the games, it was always, there was a very specific reason why it happened. It also has, for some reason, Jon Snow in it.
What?
Not the newsreader.
Yeah, but the actor.
Yeah. And he plays the love interest. Because you remember the love interests in the Silent Hill games, don't you? Heather's boyfriend in Silent Hill 3. You remember that? I remember that. As in, it was, he's not going to be a boyfriend or something, is he? Because one of the things I liked about Heather in Silent Hill 3 is that she didn't need saving. She just got on with it. But yeah, he turns out that he's kind of a boyfriend love interest.
Hey, joy.
And this does have the sexy nurses in.
Oh, okay.
But it's
sexy nurses.
the Silent Hill sexy nurses are.
Oh yeah, don't you just love a nurse with her, you know, bandages wrapped around her face completely?
Yeah, and sort of just covered in scars. But it's weird. But the one thing about them that's not covered in scars, it seems to be their ample cleavage.
That's funny, that.
Yeah, it's odd. It seems to spend a lot of time on the cleavage, and it's just, yeah, we get it. They're sexy nurses. We get it. But it's just it's like a mess. It is like someone decided to do you know, like a high school film project.
Ooh.
And threw a little bit of money at it for CG.
Actually, funny you should say film project. Because this week I'd watched Another Earth, which is a... I think it's a winner of a... What is it, 2012?
11.
Sorry, 2011. I think it was at Independent Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a low sci-fi about a woman that does something that is kind of almost inexcusable, goes to prison. Then when she comes out, she kind of has to try and kind of face up and like deal with it.
Is hers the vote that elects Nigel Farage as Prime Minister? Because that would be fairly inexcusable.
But, no, basically, while this is all going on, another planet comes into being, kind of not far away.
Well, it doesn't. Isn't it almost like it gets closer and closer and closer until you can literally see Earth above Earth?
Yeah, so it's basically a complete replica of our planet, including its people and whatnot.
Right.
And she enters a competition to, get a rocket there. Rocket to this alternate Earth.
Okay.
And
that's about as much as I'm going to tell you, because...
But that's almost most of the sci-fi element, but the majority of the film isn't about the sci-fi.
No, and it does... In my opinion, it's kind of a bit of a glorified film student project.
Mm.
Because it just... Because when you do script writing at uni, you're kind of told, show, don't tell.
Yeah.
There is very, very little dialogue in this. It's obvious that somebody's gone to, you know, kind of a lecture and, you know, kind of heard this show, don't tell, and have decided to basically take it to its extreme where it's, you know, almost...
Some of the scenes are quite impenetrable because people aren't talking.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a lot of emotion going on and whatnot, but most of the time, you don't necessarily want to be just, you know, dealing with just, like, faces and glances and lingering cameras, and to me, that isn't really the point of films.
Mm.
And it just...
It's kind like, of, you can do that, yeah. But don't just do that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there was quite a lot of tension and, you know, you could understand what the character's going through and everything, but it just felt a little bit slow.
Mm.
And I know it's the kind of film that I know a lot of kind of more academic-y film students would like, but it's not the kind of film that I would necessarily like. But I did kind of like it because, you know, the concept of kind of another kind of identical Earth and whatnot.
It sounds a bit quite interesting. Trench,
to be honest, if you've kind of seen some of the crime dramas and whatnot that have kind of come from Europe onto our TVs, it has a similar feel to that because they're using a lot of unknown actors and because they're using a lot lot less kind of speech and, you know, whatnot to do stuff. So, yeah, it does have a slight kind of aesthetic like that. Along with, the fact that it has naturalistic lighting and stuff.
Hmm.
So they've...
Everything ended up very blue in a lot of the film, though, as well.
Mm. Like, oh, it must be French,
the lighting in that.
If you see what I did there,
yeah.
French. I think we can kind of ignore that. I'm sorry.
But it was... Oh, I just found it kind... It wasn't that I wanted there to be tons of sci-fi going on. It was just the way they were doing the character development. I was like, I see what you did there and keep doing there, and I kind of wish you'd stop.
Absolutely. I mean, it kind of... How long does it last? About 88 minutes?
It was
about
88 minutes, yeah.
So it's nigh on 1 hour, 1.5 hours.
It's a short film, if you go back to what we were talking about last week. But it feels like an incredibly like, you can't believe that it's only been that many minutes when you sort of check the running time and stuff, or sort of look at the progression bar if you've paused it or something. It's like, oh, I'm only that far into it.
It
how?
It feels like there should have been other stories within that story, you know, kind of other stories within the meta story.
Maybe what they should do, right, is have the exact same film, but in moments where they just have characters, you know, exchanging glances. Just have giant robots fighting in the background behind them.
I think it worked, I suppose.
So is that on Netflix or is it a...
No, this is something we got on
Blu-ray. Because I saw the I saw a trailer for it and I thought it was actually quite an interesting concept. Mm. And then I come to realise that that concept was the entire film.
Is it? Yeah, it and was
it's,
just...
It's like... Yeah.
Subplots were not something that were perhaps widely used.
I mean, to be fair, it looked like... the budget for it probably wasn't that much. It was probably, I wouldn't necessarily say a shoestring budget, but quite a low budget film. And it was like done by Fox Searchlight as well. So
well, they probably they distributed it.
Well, yeah, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was an interesting one, but it's not something that I'd watch again within the next about year or two.
Maybe we could just lend it to someone sometime, and if it never comes back, it never comes back.
Hey, no. I spent money on that.
It's not a really bad film. It's just an incredibly boring film. There we go. That's the truth of the matter after seeing through that thing.
I liked it, but I'm very, very aware that it's not something that a lot of people would like.
And speaking of things a lot of people didn't like, but in fact probably cost people a lot more for people not really liking it, World War Z was something I rewatched over the weekend.
Well, it was one of the films.
One of the films. We watched a lot of films over the weekend.
It's got Peter Capaldi in it.
Yep.
Yep.
And I made a joke about the fact that he was one of the people in the Who building.
Yes. I noticed that too. I got far too much enjoyment out of that.
But rewatching it, so it's the second time I've watched it now, and I think because in the original book of World War Z, the source is gone into a bit more detail. Like there's the suspicion that it's originated in China, specifically in the Three Gorges Dam area, but nothing to that extent happens in this film. And considering that it's almost like a really horrible form of rabies, it's just kind of like, I think I've come to a point now where I can't handle zombie texts unless they talk about their origins a bit more. I like having all the human drama and stuff and the race to, you know, save lives and get out of places and survive and all that. But considering that so much of the film was kind of based on weird pseudoscience, I feel a bit unfulfilled by, again, not knowing where the thing came from.
I think, for me, World War Z was actually quite good because it was actually it was intelligent in its use of, you know, kind of, well, stuff to protect yourself. Like the fact that out of all of the zombie films and whatnot that have really ever been done, I think Brad Pitt's character, Jerry, is the first one to turn around and go, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. That's how long it takes to turn. Or even like, taping magazines up to his arms so that, you know,
he's got a bit of protection.
Yeah. And even to a certain extent, chopping off the arm of...
Well, mind you, that's something that's been done in a couple of zombie films.
True, but I mean, it's that kind of intelligence behind it that I think makes it slightly more unique. But I think, bearing in mind that the source text was, you know, World War Z, which is like, what is it, the second of
Max Brooks's?
Because wasn't there the Zombie Survivor Guide?
He's got a Zombie Survivor Guide, and World War Z's kind of like a lot of the theories that ended up in the Survival Guide sort of like made fiction, like, because it's obviously a narrative. And I can deal with the fact now that it's fast zombies in the film rather than the slow zombies of the book. I can deal with that now. But it's just not knowing what the source is. It just kind of frustrates me I don't like having this puzzle left. Like, I could deal with there not being a happy ending to a zombie film if I knew where things came from.
To be fair, I think the reason... Because I wasn't that bothered about where it came from, because, one, they identified a request to know where it was from, but, two, because that was basically just turning around and saying, we want to know where it's come from so that we know how to stop it. And in the end, they bypass the whole question of where it's come from and at least have or develop a weapon that they could use. So, to me, it wasn't such an important issue.
But it's just a piece of the mystery that never gets solved in so many zombie things nowadays.
Very true, but the one, you know, when it does get solved, it's usually quite cheesy and it kind of breaks down. You know, at some of the sci-fi elements.
I think it's okay if it's in something like, you know, Walking Dead, where you're dealing with characters who are isolated anyway. Because then it's just something that's happening. But
mind you, the fact that they spent part of, was it season one in CDC, in Atlanta, it was just kind of like, and obviously there was the wrong revelation, which then gets revealed in season two. But at the same time, somehow the CDC guy doesn't know where it's come from. And that just annoyed the hell out of me.
I like the fact that Walking Dead, because they had that bit of lore which, you know, kind of said that everybody's already infected, it kind of goes with the original concept of the zombie, which is basically that it's not just if you've been bitten, you come back as a zombie. It's the fact that if you die, you come back as a zombie.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is entirely different.
And it's what Romero mostly worked off of exactly. as well. Moving away from zombies, I also happened to watch with Paul the two recent Star Trek films. Now, I managed to really, really enjoy watching, you know, the first new Star Trek film again. Really, really enjoyed that. And then I watched Into Darkness straight after and I was just like, because it was like I'd seen the new, like the first one of the new series a couple of times, but watching Into Darkness, that was only the second time I'd seen it.
Yeah.
And
where you can be a little bit more, you know what's coming, so you can sort of absorb it easier. Yeah.
And I was just kind of, yeah, I'm still not that keen on it. Like, I really hope that they perhaps improve on things for the third film. And I don't know if that's possible now or not, with the fact that Abrams won't be taking up the directorial roles for that because of his Star Wars commitment.
You know, the one thing that I was actually thinking with rewatching Star Trek Reboot, is in the first film, is that basically the plot is that basically the Romulan mining ship ends up coming from the future into the past, destroying that one ship that Kirk's father was on and whatnot. Yep, that's fine. Hides away for ages, then suddenly attacks Vulcan. Starfleet goes there, gets destroyed by the, you know, ship, and then that goes to Earth, in which Kirk follows with the Enterprise and manages to, you know, destroy the ship.
If I remember right, and though,
The entirety of the plot revolves around first the ship coming out and waiting around, and then attacking Vulcan, followed by Earth, and that's it. It's, you know, it's kind of weird how that kind of took, you know, it's like 2 hours.
Yeah, but I can't remember the name of the Romulan bloke now.
Nero,
that was it. He got arrested and imprisoned by the Klingons, but that got cut out.
Yeah, we saw a blooper thing which showed Klingons, but it was a blooper take of that scene.
Yeah.
So why did they cut that?
I don't know, for time, but otherwise it's just, yeah, why does he attack the ship that Kirk's father is on? Well, Kirk's parents, and, you know, kill his father. And then just buggers off for years. It's not really covered.
No.
I mean, I suppose it's the fact that they're kind of, I don't know if one of them, one of his lackeys seemed to be reasonably intelligent in doing calculations. And there seemed to be a whole kind of like, oh, you know, Spock isn't going to have come through yet. Due to physics.
What I want to know is how they actually worked out when Spock and where Spock was going to come through.
Math, apparently.
Science. But they didn't even, because they went through the black hole singularity first or whatever, Spock came in afterwards, but surely they couldn't have known the precise, you know, moment that they that it came through, and therefore the moment that he would come out.
Well, you could say that, you know, if they worked it out, if it was because, you know, of the mass of the ship, their ship was much bigger.
Right, okay.
So, you know, it's conceivable in a, yeah, I know this is kind of just excusing it, but, you know, they could work out, you know, conceivably work out. You know, it makes sense to me that, you know, there'd be reasoning for it.
Yeah, but that's on the assumption that the mass would affect how far it went back through time.
Yeah, we're talking about massive stabby ship that's apparently just for mining.
Yeah.
Going back in time, so I don't know.
Mm.
I mean, I've got issues about the first Star Trek film, but I was, you know, prepared to put them to one side.
It entertained me, the first one. Into Darkness, on the other hand, part of it was like, because Cumberbatch just seems so underused.
You've got Benedict Cumberbatch as a baddie. How can you possibly waste that?
But it was.
And yet they manage.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, it's only the second time that I've seen it, because we saw it at the cinema, and that was absolutely ages ago when it first came out in the cinema. And I completely forgot that they actually managed to stick him in cold storage. So, you know, they can conceivably bring Khan back.
That's never a good thing, just setting up for that.
Although the one thing that I did or didn't really appreciate about Star Trek Into Darkness was the fact that basically the Enterprise seemingly got so trashed, and yet still by the end it was kind of still in space, you know, kind of floating and, you know, going around and stuff. And it's like, you've been attacked. Your shields have been drained and whatnot. You've had massive holes punctured in your, you know, starship and
you
whatnot.
You were, in fact, so badly damaged, you lost the ability to fight the gravitational pull of a planet and was pulled into its atmosphere.
Which is a fairly major thing for a starship.
Yeah.
I kind of appreciate the scope, you know, of stuff, but, I don't know, it seemed like, I suppose to a certain extent, it also felt like it was too focused, you know, kind of on Earth. It felt like it was a much, much smaller universe than the TV series. I suppose you kind of have to kind of be okay with that, you know,
tried to hint at things not being so small, though, by having all these really random alien species kind of show up in the crew of the Enterprise. Or am I the only person that noticed that part?
No.
And I still don't understand what Scotty's little companion. Wait, this is two films now, and we don't really have a name for that guy yet, do we? That little alien.
No, we don't. I don't think we do.
No. Just a bit of an oversight, I think.
They're just space racists.
All right, I'm going to move us on now to.
Although, hang on, I will pop in with the, you know, coincidentally, I sat down and watched Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan this weekend. And it's so much better than Into Darkness. It's not funny. For all its 80s cheese and Shatner chewing the scenery, it's still a far better film than Into Dark. It just is.
To be fair, even the title is more appropriate. Because Into Darkness, what exactly was that meant to mean?
I'm pretty sure we heard Mark Kermode rant about that once, in person.
What, just the name?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, why Into Darkness? I mean, it's not as though, you know, there was some sort of, like, big black darkness that, you know, was there. It was like, no, it was basically Wrath of Khan, but retold
in the reboot universe. It was Wrath of Khan retold very badly because they tried squeezing in the original Wrath of Khan episode of the TV series with the, you know, the cryogenically frozen crew and who he is and everything like that. And the fact that he was Khan was the worst kept secret I've seen in the film in ages. I knew it was Khan before the film was out, and they were insisting, no, it's not Khan, it's not Khan, it's not Khan. It's Khan.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just, there was so much wrong with, you know, Into Darkness, whereas you have Wrath of Khan, and it's very focused in comparison.
Just to check, Wrath of Khan is the one that's got Laura doing that dance, right?
No.
What?
No, which one's got the dance? Because I hate that dance.
Is that the one with the feathers?
Yeah.
I think that might be Star Trek V.
Okay. I can not talk about that. That's good. It's good.
Yeah, well, it's a shit film anyway. As I've said before, when it comes to Star Trek, the original Star Trek films, motion picture good, but a bit long. Wrath of Khan good. 3 is shit, 4 is shit, 5 is shit, 6 is very good. Yeah, I hate the whales.
I mean, it's been said that, you know, it's like, it's mostly the evens, even-numbered Star Trek films are good. And then the odd, and I think so far in this reboot universe, it's the odd ones that are good, and the even ones that are not.
Well,
so
we got to see a Star Trek 3 out of this lot, to be sure on this,
To be honest, I would much prefer it if they actually just made a TV series reboot of Star Trek than actually continue with the films.
Yes, because the films are... The films have a problem where you have to find a good enough story to film, you know, to fill the running time. And when it comes to them so far, they haven't really succeeded.
I mean, if you consider...
I liked the original because, it kind of worked, even though, as I said, I had problems with it.
But if you consider...
Good enough for a first.
Yeah. If you consider what can be done with TV series nowadays and how good they actually look, you know, and you kind of look back at Star Trek, you know, and fair enough, it was kind of, you know, kind of going from the 80s to, you know, kind of, well, I can't remember whether it was actually just past the 2000s. But if you redid it now, it could look still absolutely blooming brilliant. It really could.
Yeah, just the amount you can do in a TV series now. And, you know, for the money they were throwing at them.
Yeah.
They'd make it back.
Absolutely. The TV series of today look like the movies of back then.
Yeah.
All right, I am going to move us on now to our interview with Hannah Bunce, a video game tutorial designer and founder of Tutorials by Design. Thanks for agreeing to talk with me, Hannah.
No problem.
Okay, well, it can't be every BSc Computer Games Development undergrad who decides to make tutorials and their design the subject of their dissertation. What compelled you to make it the subject of yours?
Well, I've got a background in psychology, and what interested me coming from a psychology background was how people interact with not just video games, but digital items. So when it came time to decide what to do for my dissertation, I knew that I wouldn't have the core programming skills to do a full game like other people did. So I sat back and thought, right, what interests me and what can I do to get an excellent grade? So I pitched the idea to my lecturers, and they loved it, which I wasn't expecting them to do. I was expecting a bit of a fight from them, because obviously they wanted me to do proper programming. I didn't want to do that.
Okay, no, that's fair. It does look like you ended up producing a really interesting dissertation. One of the things you identified in your research was that there were like 7 main types of tutorial. What were they? At least what vaguely do they involve?
The first one that I identified was, I know I haven't come up with like proper titles, like terms for these yet. I'm working on that, sort of. It's a narrative-based tutorial, which I found in the games such as Fallout 3 and Metal Gear Solid, because obviously in Fallout 3 you start off being Bourne, like that's how the game begins, so you get taught how to play the game through the context of learning how to be a human. The second one I identified was through visual cues, such as in Portal, and again Fallout 3. In Portal you've got the environment art of each level, which shows diagrams right at the beginning of the level, and it incorporates the environment art into how to get through that level. And then in Fallout 3 you've got the visual cues of the companion characters that you can pick up along the way. The third one is manuals. Yeah, we all love good paper manuals. Going back a few decades with games such as Legend of Zelda, the original Final Fantasy, I think that came with a 90-page manual, I believe.
Oh my goodness.
Don't quote me on that, because okay. I'm not entirely sure. But I know that there was a lot of pages in the Final Fantasy manual, and that was just in a single language manual. Then the next one was where you have a manual, but you have no in-game help, such as Dark Souls. Now, I've not actually played Dark Souls myself, because the thought of it terrifies me, but I watched a few Let's Plays of it to identify with what the designers were trying to do. And I looked up the manual for that one, which covers extensively how to create a character, types of classes there are, and a brief overview of the controls, which is essentially what you want from a manual and a tutorial. The next one is my most hated type, which is forced tutorials, where you can't actually do anything until you touch the controls that the game is telling you to, such as in Roller Coaster Tycoon. The day before I handed in my dissertation, Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon was released,
okay,
which has the best forced tutorial I've ever seen. It knows it's a forced tutorial, and it's done in such a humorous way that it's really memorable, and you don't find yourself being frustrated, you find yourself laughing along with it, which is quite an interesting way of doing it. The next one that I found is a bit sort of thinking outside box with this, is optional tutorials, and my example for that would be Minecraft. I've argued the point that its achievement list is actually a tutorial, because when you open up the achievement list, I will say I haven't played Minecraft in about a year, so it might have changed for all I know now. When you open the achievements list, it shows you sort of the paths, the tech trees, if you will, of the achievements, and essentially what you've got to do to unlock the next achievement, to find out what next to do to unlock the next achievement. And the final one, which is my favourite, is where there's nothing in-game or external to the game, so you've got no manual, nothing whatsoever. And I found that in Mega Man 10. I watched an excellent series of videos based on that, which I can't remember what it's called, but I shall let you know if you want to put it a note with the episode.
Okay, wow, that is pretty extensive. So obviously, having looked at different games and their different ways of doing tutorials, for you, other than say Mega Man 10, are there any other games which you find have some of the best tutorial designs, and why is it so good?
I really like the way in which Portal is a tutorial for Portal 2, although you don't have to play Portal 1 to play Portal 2. It seems like the entire aspect of Portal 1 is just a training video for the main game of Portal 2. And going on from that, really, is, I guess, the way the Assassin's Creed series handles the narrative context of the Animus, where at the beginning of each game, you're told that there's been a few upgrades to the Animus, so they have to go through the motion controls of the in-game character, that Desmond, in the first few games, to teach him how to use the Animus, but then it's also teaching you how to play the game. Basically, I quite like the mix of visual cues and narrative tutorials.
I need to ask, because obviously then at the opposite end of the scale, which game tutorials have perhaps made you cry and why? I just want to tell you right now, my personal I hate tutorial is the one for Fahrenheit, the Quantic Dream game.
I've not actually played that.
Oh my gosh. Cage shouldn't have been allowed to make that tutorial. It's forced and it's really pernickety because it involves a lot of use of the analog sticks.
Yeah.
Or at least on console. And so you're just kind of like, I can't quite get it, oh god no, kind of deal. But for you, which would your worst nightmare of tutorial game be?
I guess Dishonored, because I haven't found any evidence to back this up, but I have a sneaky suspicion that its tutorial is linked to the difficulty level that you choose. I played it when it first came out, absolutely loved it, then I picked it back up again on PS3 at the end of last year. And I quite like to play my games on easy. I'm there for the story. It started taking me through the tutorial, and I was like, I already know this. There must be a way to turn the tutorial hints off. So I went digging through some menus, and I found the option to switch tutorial hints, or game hints, I think they're called, off. But it was greyed out.
What?
So on a whim, I changed the difficulty up, and then suddenly I could edit this option. I felt then I was being punished for playing the game on easy. And I guess in a similar fashion, Bioshock Infinite, I can't really remember much about the main game, but I've recently just finished playing Burial at Sea Episode 1. And I came back to that after a good few weeks of not playing. And I still remembered the controls. That was fine. But every 5 minutes, the game was just popping up with pop-ups telling me, oh, if you want to do this, press this button. If you want to change your weapon, press this button. I'm like, I know. Like, you're actively stopping me from playing the game right now. That caused me quite... It's only like a few seconds of frustration, but for some people, that's enough to make them never want to play the game again.
Yeah, because I played through Infinite, like the main game, twice. And yeah, even though obviously I had a save file the second time round, it was just kind of like, oh no, you know, we're going to tell you how to eat eggs again.
Yeah.
It's just like it's great.
It's got to be really simple just to put a check in saying, does this person have a save file? Or hell, even look through the achievement list, because most games these days have trophies or achievements signifying that you finished the game. So if there's a check in place for either a save file or that final achievement, yeah, then sort of like a new game plus sort of thing, they could just skip over the whole tutorial.
I mean, I suppose if they're just trying to cover their own asses in a way because of like, oh, somebody might start playing the game and then put it down for like a month but then decide not to start a new game.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but then perhaps they should actually have something that's kind of internally counting down the lapse of time between those events.
I quite like where you've just got the option in the menu, because most players like to feel like they're in control of their interactivity level. So just having a check in the menu saying, do you want tutorials on or off? And most people would be perfectly happy at that. Hopefully.
Next question. Are there different needs for the user or game itself when it comes to tutorials for mobile in comparison to, say, consoles and PC? Like, is there sort of different considerations about how you get the information across, do you think?
Definitely, yes. Because with mobile games, think about how you hold your phone if you're playing a game. Your thumbs or your hands are in the way. So you've got to really think about how most people hold their phones and where best to put the information on the screen. Or this is where the menu options come in quite handy, because you've got such a limited space on a mobile screen. So yeah, if you just have a message that comes up at the start of the game with a very brief introduction, because most mechanics on mobile games are really simple, they require one or two touches, if that, at the same time. So just a screen to start with that signifies this, preferably in images as opposed to words, because something that I had drilled into me from like year 10 onward is when you do the presentation, for example, make sure you have as little text as possible, because people will garner more information from images. So if you have images as opposed to text, and then have a longer sort of FAQ section in the menu so you can just bring up at any time, is probably the best for mobile, in my opinion.
No, that's fair, and I think I have to agree. I'm not a huge like mobile, like smartphone or tablet kind of gamer, but I've definitely preferred it when it's not been lots of text.
Yeah.
In order to figure out how the heck I play something. Outside of tutorials, are there any other aspects of game design that you think get overlooked? Because obviously tutorials, I mean, to me, they always feel a bit last minute for a lot of games. But are there any other aspects of game design that you think get overlooked, and where do you think this perhaps happens?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, for my day job, I work at a social gaming company as a QA tester, and the amount of time and effort everybody puts into designing the new releases that we put out on a month-by-month basis is a lot higher than I thought it would be, because before working at this job, I thought that social games were just made overnight, essentially. Like, I was completely oblivious to the whole process. So now that I've seen the inside of how social games are made, I definitely don't think that social games designs is overlooked. But I think mostly with regards to console games, enemy balancing, there's difficulty scaling, I've tried so many times to work out the logic behind what some designers must have been thinking when they were designing the enemy system. Some things just don't make sense. Like, I played a game, I can't remember for the life of me what it was called, where on easy, that was it, it was The Last of Us, sorry.
Oh god, yes please, do tell.
I was playing on easy, and I got to about halfway through the game, or it might have been just under halfway through, where I'd just come out of the hotel, I think it was the hotel, and Ellie stayed up on a balcony with a sniper rifle to sort of cover my ass whilst I went around this big open plaza. This big open plaza had, I believe, 11 enemies. Ellie didn't do anything. I had no ammo. Again, still playing on easy, so you'd have thought that after a massive thing like the hotel took about, you know, a good 2 to 3 hours to clear, you'd have thought there'd be some ammo drops in there, especially leading up to what felt like an ending of a chapter. And there was nothing, and these enemies just killed me in about 30 seconds. I have no idea how or why, but I really think that players playing on easy, they should be given more ammo, because that's how you make those types of games easier, is you give them more ammo or more health packs. More health packs would have worked, or even Ellie shooting somebody. That might have saved my ass.
It wasn't much better on normal. That's what I played it on.
And yeah, quite a few people have told me that, and where's the logic in medium being better than easy? Yeah. I could rant about this for hours, I'm sorry.
Oh, do you know something that I do know where the difficulty is kind of weirdly skewed? It's in, like, the GameCube and Wii versions of Resident Evil 4. Like, if you play on professional, or you can get to a point where it's easier than if you've played on normal, depending on how badly you've done. Resident Evil 4 gets easier the more you die. It gets harder the more you succeed.
Yeah.
And it can just get absolutely insane sometimes. But I'm going to move on to my next question. If you were making a game, how would you prefer to incorporate tutorials? And obviously, you know, going back to the earlier question, would it that also be dependent on genre and platform?
Not only would it be dependent on genre and platform, it would also be dependent on the target audience and the demographics. Because if, say, you're designing a game aimed at little children, you're going to design the tutorial completely different to what if you were designing a game aimed at adults. There's so many factors that, even though, as far as I'm aware, I'm the only person to have ever researched this topic, there's so many factors that even I haven't worked out all the kinks. There's definitely no size fits all when it comes to tutorials. Yet, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully there wouldn't be in a way if we continue to have a diversity of games with different needs. So, yeah. I noticed that you, on your website and that you say that you enjoy participating in game jams.
I do, yeah.
Can you describe some of your fondest game jam moments?
It's always hitting that submit button every single time. There's just that sense of accomplishment. Because every Legendary I've entered, I've done two entries. I've done one for the competition and one for the jam. And most people think I'm insane for doing that. Like, most people find it difficult just to make one game in 48 hours, let alone two. So I quite like that sense of accomplishment, because if you put me on a deadline, I will do something. If you don't put me on a deadline, I just won't do that. But recently, I participated in my first community game jam, because all the previous ones I'd done before, I'd always been by myself, you know, holed up in my bedroom for an entire weekend, barely seeing daylight. But back in March, I went along to the Manchester game jam, and just the sense of community, and like, we weren't working together, I wouldn't even say we were working against each other, we were just a bunch of about 10 of us sat in one room having a laugh, making games and just having a really good time. So my fondest memory of that one would be when it came to present the game, because that was my first sort of like in-person game jam, so that was the first time I'd had to stand up and present my game. And naturally, I made a game that was too hard for even me to complete. And I think I managed about 10 seconds into the first level before dying and having the game over screen. So that was quite embarrassing, but also quite hilarious at the time.
No, that does sound pretty, yeah, I like that. Okay, I'm assuming you'd be a good person to hit up on this because of your degree, but are there any particular books or other media you think someone who's recently become interested in game design should experience? Because obviously they're hopefully playing lots of games, but if they want to read about it.
I don't know, I haven't found any really good books on game development or game design. So, like, my number one advice whenever anybody asks me this type of question is just to get out there and meet other designers, whether it be on Twitter or actually go along to a game jam. Like, the information that you can garner just from just even conversations like this is 10 times more memorable and more involved than just sitting down and reading a book, because video games are obviously interactive. I think the best way to learn about them is to be interactive.
No, that is fair. Yeah, and also you qualified my other media question.
Yeah.
So that's cool. And finally, just to end on this game jam theme that I've introduced, what would be your top 5 tips for surviving a game jam?
Number one is don't panic. Never panic. Because if you panic, you'll get stressed and nothing good ever comes of being stressed. That's number one. Number two is don't be afraid to take a break. Yes, you're on a time limit, but it's no good working for 24 hours straight and not having anything good at the end because you're so burned out. Whereas if you take a break every few hours, you come back nice and refreshed and get ready to work for, like, say, 4 hours, take a break, work another 4 hours, take a break. That's number two. Number three, that would be don't just eat junk food. It does seem easier to eat junk food whilst in a game jam, but then my experience anyway, eating junk food makes me feel really lethargic and dead, essentially, which is not what you want at a game jam. Four would be back up your work, back it up. Even if you feel ridiculous pressing the save button every few minutes, if you don't, you know you're going to end up regretting it. The first Sudden Dies I entered, I was using my desktop PC and there was a power cut halfway through. I hadn't pressed save in quite a while. I was quite upset for obvious reasons, and since then I've made sure I press the save button quite often. And the final one would be really just have fun. Yes, some game jams are run like an actual competition. Some of them, there are even actual prizes. But most of them, you're there just to have fun and to make games and not serious, unless you go into like competitive game jams, which I've only heard of a few myself. Just have fun.
I think the idea of a overly competitive game jam, it just, like you said, it doesn't sound fun, you know, because you just be stressing out trying to get the prize, and it's just like, well,
like, when you add competition to it, it sounds like work. And I don't like doing work when I'm not in work. How I barely like doing work when I'm in. No,
Well, thank you for the interview, Hannah. It has been wonderful picking your brain about tutorials and game jams. It really has.
No problem. Really fun being here.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. So it's goodbye from.
It's goodnight from me, Paul Wood. I'm Super Retroid on Twitter and retroid@uringipper.net.
It's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I'm on Twitter as Paul Blewett, and I have a website, paul-blewett.com.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891. You can find NerdAssemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes, Stitcher. We're on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. Plus, we're on Facebook and Google Plus as NerdAssemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimension.com for stuffs. Lots of stuffs of geekish like nature. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I'm Batman.
Shut up, Bruce.